Good morning. It is February 26th. If you can hardly believe it, two more days left this month and we're on to March.
Wow.
And we might get some snow yet in March. We're just going to wait and see. But this is the House Education. Oh, my gosh. This is the Subcommittee on Education for Ways and Means. It's February 26th, and today we have the opportunity to hear about Senate Bill 5538, and that's the budget bill for teacher standards and practices. And we are going to start. You got ladies ready? Okay. You know, there's detention at 3. Doug, do you want to start?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, on your OLIS, on your screens, there's a number of materials for this agency. The first item is the presentation they'll be going through, which should also be on the screen as they go through it. Also included in that is the last presentation, which will follow Ms. Chamberlain's presentation, plus some supporting documents, including material, a little bit more detailed material on their budget and their budget presentation. There's some testimony from a Mr. Porter, and then there's material from us that is available, just some background material on the board. In terms of the Teacher Standards Practices Commission, there's at least one bill out there that is significant to them. I'm sure they'll mention more, but there is a bill that does basically two things: changes the name of the board and also increases the limits on fees. And this, the governor's budget is dependent on a fee increase, something that you encouraged as a subcommittee to really look at 2 years ago because of backlogs and falling revenues. That bill is referred to Ways and Means, which is House Bill 2411, I believe, and will make its way down here. In our presentation is some in the LFO presentation document that's there. There's some information on what the fees will be, as well as comparisons on an annual basis to other fees for other occupations, just to give you an idea where their fee structure lies with a whole host of other occupations, some of which you heard in the past 2 weeks or over the past 2 weeks in this subcommittee. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Chamberlain and her commission chair. And just to note that we will need to have public testimony today if anyone signs up. And then if this runs and does not complete today, Ms. Chamberlain can come back Monday morning and we can finish this up prior to Department of Education starting theirs, if there's enough discussion to go on beyond the 5 to 10 or whenever you want to close the meeting.
Okay, thank you, and welcome Director Chamberlain and head of the commission, Executive Director Heidi Seip. These are wonderful friends, so welcome, and Vicki, if you want to go ahead and get started.
Sure. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Chamberlain, the Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Just briefly, for the folks who don't know me, my background is former teacher. I have a legal background. I worked for the School Boards Association, the Community College Association, before I took this job at TSPC 13 years ago. And I have the very good fortune of having Heidi Seip as my chair this year and last year, and I'll let her introduce herself.
Good morning, Representative Comp, Senator Monroe, members of the committee, you just about got moved to a commission. thank you for the opportunity to join you. I am probably an unlikely advocate for TSPC in that I have worn a variety of hats through the years, and so I currently serve as a Lewis and Clark adjunct professor. I was a teacher who transferred in from Washington and had various license experiences at that time. Currently a superintendent, prior to that assistant superintendent, who ran all of the highly qualified and licensure issues for our school district. And then I worked at ODE as the assistant superintendent there for a time and oversaw CTE and highly qualified, where again licensure issues come to be. And when I started, in my spare time I'm a robotics coach, thanks to Betty. So in addition to all of those various experiences, I honestly thought that there was a lot of challenges with TSPC, and I was pretty frustrated in a lot of areas. And so when I joined the commission, I did so with the goal of trying to better understand what the challenges were and do everything I could to improve the agency as a whole, because I really thought that was necessary. It's been a very eye-opening experience, because essentially nothing that I assumed was correct. There are definitely challenges, however, they do not stem from the areas in which I originally assumed. And so the last few years have been a really interesting journey. And I think as we visit today, you'll hear all those various perspectives in the work we're trying to do to move forward. I'm very proud of the commission right now, and I'm really hopeful for the transition point that we're just about at. And I think it's going to be a really exciting next couple of years.
Thank you. And I would encourage members of the committee to ask questions as we move through it, so you don't lose it in your mind. And I know that teacher standards and practices has everything from a phenomenal background of success to people that are a little bit cranky about it. And so if we can bring those any issues out that you're concerned with, that's our job of the committee. So Vic, you're going to start?
Yep.
Awesome. Okay, here we go.
We wanted to start here with our mission, and I'm not going to read it to you because you can do that. But the commission was very careful to call to people's attention that licensure is about the kids. In other words, that the standards are to... Oh, so it is not all the way up there. yes, it is. Benefit of Oregon. Students is the only word missing. So we base our goals and our functions. Here it is. Okay, thank you. The slides are too big, a little bit too big. On the three buckets of work that we do, which is set the standards for the licenses, basically accredit or approve the programs that prepare folks, and then do discipline on the license. And the commission works on policy issues. Do you want to say a little something about that?
I know that it is in no way comparable to the amount of reading that you all do to serve. However, every commission meeting entails thousands of pages usually of reading, and we have various committees and subcommittees that tackle key issues. But the key thing that I've really grown to appreciate is the variety of perspectives from the various commissioners, as well as the depth of the work and also the detail in which we have to consider broad policy issues. One of the things that we've done as a commission is we monitor backlog reports, we monitor discipline reports, so we always know how many we have coming, where we're at, what progress we've made, and where we need to rethink our course.
For your information, the commission meets quarterly, so that because we are made up of practitioners, professional educators are in the classroom, 12 of them are in the classrooms or buildings, and pulling them out of school isn't a good idea. So we have one meeting in the summer and three meetings during the academic school year. The commission's agency goals are what we base our key performance measures on, and the first one is obviously striving for excellence in the preparation of our educators. And then the second part of that is providing leadership for those standards. In other words, supporting them and defending them and making sure that they're viable. The third one actually relates to agency staff, and that is trying to do everything we can to provide high quality, timely services, and which we'll get into more detail later is one of our biggest challenges right now. Finally, when I arrived, the rules had become quite a hodgepodge of sort of cut and paste type of measures, and we have spent the last 13 years cleaning them up, eliminating unnecessary ones, and making them more readable. And then finally, the work that the commission does with professional standards, and we'll talk about that in more detail as we get to the discipline issues.
And Vicki, we're going to take a minute. Since Senator Thompson is here, we are going to, what do I need to do?
Just officially open the meeting.
Okay. We missed you. Welcome.
Welcome.
We're now officially having a public hearing on Senate Bill 5538.
Thank you. Heidi's going to talk a little bit about the historical perspective, but I just want to call to your attention that Oregon had the very first ever professional standards board for educators, and it was established in 65. There are 11 other boards like us nationally. And then the legislature in 1973, which was a very big year at the legislature, carved us out as a separate board and commission like a lot of the other licensure boards and commissions. I'm going to ask Heidi to talk a little bit about the composition of the commission, because a lot of folks don't realize I report to that board. I'm accountable to that board, and she chairs that group of people.
So there are 17 commissioners, and two at large or one?
Three
public members. Everyone else is involved in education, whether it be K-12 educator, college representative. We have an ESD representative, and we have a superintendent representative, as well as principal representatives. And that variety of perspectives brings a real value to the commission, in that every decision that's being made about educators is made by educators, as well as with just different levels of education as well. One of the misconceptions I had about the commission ahead of time was that honestly, I thought people just all voted in blocks, and that something would come forward and there would be a powerful lobby and it would just happen that way. I've yet to see that happen. Instead, what I see is a lot of really engaged, involved discussion. I see some really hard conversations happening. I see sometimes where people aren't happy with one another during a discussion, but then they come around and support the action of the whole. I've been really inspired by the people that are on the commission. I've been inspired by their willingness to take a hard stance and their willingness to think for themselves and to think of how any decision will relate to their profession as well as their students. And one of the biggest examples of this that I can think of, I'd say EdTPA. Do you think that was probably the best example of that? So we passed EdTPA this last spring, and it was highly controversial. And where it came from was for a few years. Pardon me?
Can you say what those letters stand for?
I cannot. What does EdTPA stand for?
Senator Smith, one of the, you can always look it up on the internet. Vicki, go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Smith Warner. It stands for Education Teacher Performance Assessment. So we'll get into a little bit more detail mm-hmm. about that in a little bit when we talk about our initiatives and mm-hmm. our performance.
And Representative Huffman has a question.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Since we're slowed down here, Heidi, are they 4-year terms for the commissioners, and can they do two of those, or what does that look
2-year
like?
2-year terms.
Okay.
And two, three, pardon me, 3-year terms and two of those.
Okay. Thank you.
But to answer Representative Warner's, beyond the acronym, what we had tasked the colleges with previously is we needed some sort of system to ensure quality of a prepared candidate. And what we were finding is that the final quality as people were entering the classroom really varied from program to program, and we wanted to be sure that there was some expectation of consistent quality, and we asked them to the colleges to come up with a system. Well, that went on for a couple of years, and there wasn't a system, and it wasn't that they weren't working hard. It was just that there's a lot of different minds and there's a lot of different groups, and they would not or could not come to a final decision that was consistent amongst all programs. And so we proposed EdTPA, which is a canned program, for example, to do so. And we asked them to consider that, gave them some time to look at it. And the colleges as a whole it continued to be a mixed bag on that. And so it was probably one of the most stressful meetings we've ever had. We had more public input than any other time, and commissioners walking into that meeting were all across the board. And we worked together, and we talked it through over and over and over again that day until it was done. And we're at a point now where we're moving forward. It did pass, and we're working towards greater consistency of programs so that when people enter the profession, we at least have a baseline of expectation of skills. And I'm really proud of that, but it wasn't easy. And I think it's a great indicator of the value of the variety of the commissioners and also their willingness to think independently, because there was a lot of people trying to sway opinions on that, and everyone voted for themselves, and I was really proud of them.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what I'd like to add about that is it's also an example of a sort of invisible partnership, and that is that working with OEIB, we were able to use some of the Teacher Quality Initiative funds to send to universities to train faculty to work with their candidates for this new performance assessment. It's taking the place of our old work sample. So when we get it fully implemented for the very first time, everybody exiting a teachers-only preparation program will be measured by the exact same assessment, and they'll be graded by outside scores from outside of Oregon. And it won't be subject to each individual university's point of view or that classroom teacher's point of view. And I think elevates the credibility of the quality of the candidate we're producing. So it does take some time to implement. So we've been using those funds for training and expect it to be fully consequential for licensure in the spring of 2018.
Yeah, and Vicki, is that program for private and public university teacher programs?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it is. Anybody who seeks to license teachers in Oregon has to have TSPC's approval, and that includes the privates and the publics.
Thank you.
All right. We'll move on from here to our agency's organization and do part of this quickly. This is our current organizational chart. I know it is in your materials. We have 19 FTE. We have 20 authorized FTE. We've had trouble keeping some positions open, but this is down from 25 FTE a couple biennia ago, and I'll explain that a little bit more. But our org chart is divided into our functions, program approval on the left, licensure in the middle, and investigation on the right, which is exactly the three buckets I've continued to mention that we do. So I want to move quickly into the licensure piece, which is the major piece of the work that TSPC does, and also where the major portion of our staff is. All of our fees are other, all of our funds are other funds and come exclusively from licensure fees. And I understand Doug has shared with you the comparison of TSPC fees to other licensure boards. That was a look we took also. It's not uncommon nationally for education licenses to be 3 years or 5 years. However, that doesn't mean that we don't need to modernize and look at a new structure, perhaps, to have a little bit more stability funding. With that said, right now we have we track licenses two ways. 64,000 total licenses, that would be administrators and school counselors, school psychs, and teachers, but that boils down to about 59.8 headcount. So there are teachers who also have counseling license or also have administrative licenses or some other crossover like that. And the clients that we serve aren't just the educators we license, but it also includes the school districts, the charter schools, and the ESDs who hire licensed educators. So moving on, this gives you just an idea. This is just the last calendar year. We could have taken any calendar year, but it shows you proportionately how teachers, administrators, and the other folks line up. So we gave you 89% of them are teachers, but the administrators are 7%. And what's interesting about administrators, in the entire 13 years I've been here, the number of licensed administrators has not fluctuated plus or minus 50 from 4,500 It's just one of the most stable groups we have. In other words, we're getting new ones as quickly as we're losing them or they're retiring. And I don't know what accounts for that phenomenon, but it's something that's difficult to miss. And then the school counselors and school psychologists, which are prepared in advanced programs, usually always master's plus programs, are only 4% of our licensees. Then you'll notice on the far left, as I look at it, of the chart, we also have been certifying school nurses for a number of years. And that calls to mind that in 1993, before my time, the legislature changed TSPC's vernacular from certification to licensure. And legislative council reminds us constantly that we certify nurses, we register charter school folks, and we license fully prepared educators.
Representative Springer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So, Vicki, on the school nurses piece, what does that certification look like? Because obviously that's not the professional licensure that they hold. That's through a different board, of course. So what are you doing in that certification?
Chair Comp, Representative Springer, great question. Nothing is the direct answer. These folks all must be RNs or LPNs or greater in order to get the license. I think several decades ago there was a desire that nurses who are working in school buildings have some school background preparation, but there isn't any program in Oregon that provides that anywhere. So literally anybody who is already licensed by the nursing board who wants to have a school nursing license may come to us and get it. And since I have been here, it has rarely topped 100. And this is actually one of the lowest numbers we've had in 13 years. There's no need for double licensure, candidly. I think sometimes it's hard to convince people of that. And then the other thing I will put out there is there may be some influence of collective bargaining agreements, because it's possible by holding our license it puts them into the educator bargaining unit and might result in a different wage structure. There is
follow-up, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is the cost of that license, that certification?
Madam Chair.
And one more piece to that then. I almost heard they may not be required to have that to be a, quote, school nurse. Is that accurate?
Chair Comp and Representative Springer. Depends on, it's not required by us. It's not required by the state.
Okay.
All right? It may be required by an employer. So, to answer that more completely, any nurse could work in a school and do the exact same job that somebody that we give the certification to.
And how much is that?
Oh, I even wrote it down. $100.
Thank you. For
3 years.
Thank you.
Just one more thing on demographics, and I also have information in terms of underrepresented folks in our population if you want it, but 73% of all of our licensed educators are female. So that 27% of, it's not quite a third, has been fairly consistent the whole time I've looked at the gender representation in our profession.
And Vicki, I'm gonna, since you brought up demographic, what about diversity, people of color?
Madam Chair, I'm so happy you asked. For the last time that we broke this down in 2012 and 2013, of our population, and I will tell you this, there is fewer than 2,000 educators in our database who have self-identified as underrepresented. And that's the key there, is it has to be self-identification. There isn't any other way for us to validate it. But about 0.7% are American Indian or Alaskan Native. 1.8% are Asian. 0.7% are Black or African American. 1.5% are Latino or Hispanic. We have 0.7% are multi-ethnic. And then we have about 0.2% are Native Hawaiian or other Pacific Islander. Then we have, of all of our folks, about 3.5% have chosen not to identify, and then about 0.2% have just said other. So that could be anything that isn't in here. For example, someone from Africa may not want to go into Black or African American. They may associate that with American heritage, and it's just really hard to tell. They could be perhaps Indian and don't identify as Asian. And so there's a certain percentage of the population who checks that box.
So just to put it mildly, we are still predominantly an Anglo teaching force.
91%. So all those numbers break down to 9%, which is the growth is 100% from 1991, but that's not saying much, clearly, right? When you look at the numbers, it was 4%. I remember when I was working at school boards in 1991. So it would be really nice to get that number up closer to the representing the student population.
Okay. Thank you.
So moving on, want to show you the sort of drop in the actual numbers of headcount people, licensed educators, we've had just since 2010. 4,000 at $100 an application represents nearly $500,000 dollars of revenue that's been lost over the course of the past 5 years. So that explains our revenue drop quite a bit. Fewer people are keeping their licenses. We don't have, we have new teachers who aren't becoming licensed because the job market out there still isn't spectacular. And we have retirees who are really hanging it up and not wanting to substitute or do anything else and letting their license lapse. And I think that previous to this, there were new people were coming out and becoming licensed immediately. And the retirees were hanging on to their license. But economically, people found other places to spend that money if they weren't working and using the license.
Representative Spear.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I was going to wait till later in the presentation to see if this got covered, and it probably will. But since you just kind of opened that door, it made me wonder if there's any nexus or if it is indeed true. How long does it take once a person applies for the first time, let's say, for their license? And depending on what that time is, are there other options that open up to them and they go down different avenues?
Madam Chair, Representative Springer, we have what we call a fast track for Oregon completers, and we get those done in less than 2 weeks. It's an invitation to take a cut in line, so to speak, for those applications. Only those folks. But there are other new people, and I'll show you the slide later, out-of-staters, for example, who don't. And how we work with that, let me just say, leaping ahead and leaping back, so I'll go forward. 2 years ago, we were 20 days out issuing a license. After our staffing cuts, we are now 20 weeks out issuing a license. And with less than 20 FTE across everything, it is really hard to manage that workload. So what I'm trying to tell you is if a district contacts us and let us know that they're interested in somebody who has their application in our office, we will move it through. We do everything we can to make sure people don't lose employment opportunities in the schools if they have them, if their application's in our office. Renewals, which are the bulk of our work, those licenses stay valid, and so they're not expiring and people aren't losing opportunities. So we do try to stay focused on those new folks.
Thank you.
This, and speaking of, this slide actually shows the proportion of renewals to new licenses. And need to keep in mind that new licenses would include all of our new Oregon graduates. It would include our out-of-state applicants. It would include emergency licenses, somebody looking for a last-minute substitute license. And so it tends to hover right around, if you'll notice, there's some stability in the statistic, but plus or minus 700 over the course of 7-8 years there. And that's consistent. It's the renewals that you'll see have taken a little bit of a ride and have dropped somewhat in the 2013-2014 year. But you can see the drop. We were relatively close in 07-08 to 18,000, and I'll talk a little bit more about this when I get to the backlog.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Kump. I just had a question about, is this all done online, or are people calling in also, or how does this work? It's a lot of volume. I was just curious.
Co-Chair Kump, Representative Taylor, thank you. My question's running in my head as I'm trying to think. All of our work in the office is done by hand. It's all 100% paper-based as it comes in the door. And I will explain to you how we're really way down the road in getting an online application system. So we have electronic files. So just very quickly, all of the mail comes in. It's handled by hand. It takes two people to open it if you're going to do it securely, which means nearly every single penny of our $4.5 million is touched by a human one way or the other. It could come in on a credit card slip, or it could come in with a check or a money order. Obviously, we have to have secure ways to make sure that all of that is protected, so two people open the mail. Then it's hand data entered, and then it's scanned, and it goes into an electronic file. And from there, the people issuing the licenses have all the images of the entire application. It's that entry point that we haven't been able to automate, and we're getting some help from the state with an online application system. And I'm happy to say it is done with DOJ. It's back with the NIC vendor. We're using the route that the state opened up for us to go use the Oregon.gov provider directly, and they believe they can get our online application system up this fall. So we had the very good fortune, leaping ahead again, to have serendipitously a woman working at NIC who actually designed the Hawaii Licensure Board's online system, who obtained permission to get all their codes, and now they're just moving it over, and we're going to put Oregon's name and adapt it for our licenses. And that means that we will finally join the 21st century, and people can fill out their applications online. They can upload their supporting documentation, and they can pay online. And we just remove an enormous amount of women person power in my office handling all that paper.
Follow up.
Thank
you, Chair Koppel. That sounds like moving in the right direction there. I imagine that's been very cumbersome doing it all by hand. Can you talk a little bit about, you have 20 FTE, and you're, you know, obviously that maybe will that go down? And then if with this, do you predict that to decrease? But then the second part of the question is, when obviously people need to be phoning you, if there's problems, if this is being done by hand, and so how are you handling what hours are you open? Are you, someone came and talked to me about the fact that perhaps your office is not open for phone calls from June through November, and I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Chair Kump, Representative Taylor, no. Let me tell you what we're doing now, and let me tell you what we did when we had more staff. Mm-hmm. What we are doing now is the phones open exactly at 8 o'clock, and they close actually whenever we get off the line with the last person after 5. That could be even as late as 5:30. We allow the ability to pay half hour or 45 minutes of overtime for people who are on the phone. The problem is right now with my current staffing, I at this moment have 3 people who have the capability to answer email and phones. One of them has been working there for 2 weeks. So he's versed in customer service, he still has to learn, you know, what the correct answers are. That leaves me with two people who are answering phones and email. So every single minute of the day, including lunch, we have someone answering the phone.
Okay.
Someone. And point being is the most beautifully designed, efficient model would be some mini call center, right, that would allow multiple people to take multiple calls. So when at one point 3 years ago, we actually had five people answering emails and phones, and we were able to staff for peak periods, which are before school, after school. We also started opening our lines from 7:30 to 5:30. And then during the summer, we came in half a day on Saturdays to take phone calls.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So just to take a quick look at the employment picture, we work very closely with the Department of Education. They collect the data from school districts. There isn't any point in TSPC doing duplication, so we get the employment data from them. We just received, this month, this school year's employment data, which is a big improvement for us because back in the old days, we used to not get the 2014-15 employment data till December of the next year, which is somewhat helpful, but not very. So it's wonderful right now here in the middle, close to the middle of the academic year, to be able to know precisely where people are located employment-wise. But if you'll just look, I think the story is in the last two lines, and I stole Heidi's slide. Do you want to?
Oh, it's okay. It's quite simple. Student numbers are up, educator numbers are down. That's where we're at.
Yes, Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask, in the teachers' numbers, does that include all the vocational and restricted certificates that may be just to a particular school district until? Okay. Mm-hmm. So all of those are included under the teacher licensures.
Chair Comp, Senator Roblin, what it doesn't include, however, and it has to do with how the department asked their question about employment, because I take this from the department's numbers, not our numbers. The school counselors and the school psychologists are lumped into special education, which also includes instructional assistance, and we don't have a way to sort that data out right now. So that is who would be missing from that.
Follow-up?
No, I'm okay right now. I'll get to later on.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to be clear on all of the lines' significance on this chart. So according to this, in 13-14, the total number of licensed teachers by TSPC is 60,000. But there are 28,000 employed by public schools. What are those other 30,000 doing? Are they all retired or subs that just keep their that kind of? That's how I read that. So I'm sure that's wrong. So.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith Warner, no, it's not completely wrong. I think the one of the things to keep in mind is until this biennium, schools were not hiring teachers. And I did do a four-year look back, and in 4 years prior to this school year, fewer than 30% of new Oregon graduates were getting jobs in Oregon public schools. That left 70% of our brand new teachers floating out there, and I know a lot of them substituted. I know a lot of them did instructional assistant. I know a lot of them went out of state, and I know a lot of them let their license lapse. I can't tell you what percentage. I don't have the data information yet to provide that, and I'm hoping that we'll have access to more precise data when we get our new system. So, yes, in the last 5 years, almost 50% of our active licensees were not employed in the public schools. I do not have a valid way to collect who also might be working in the private schools. I know it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000, but again, even though I have a pretty good relationship with the private K-12 schools in the state, without asking them to report in and try to do a valid collection. But it does include charter schools because they're public, this number up here. And you're accurate. It's about 50-50 right now.
Did you have a follow-up?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Just keep thinking about it.
Yeah. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vicki, is there an effort on anybody's part to manage a student's expectations, teaching student expectations? Does anybody tell a teaching student? Because we're all concerned about student debt and people getting degrees that they can't use. Do you think the average teaching student right now understands they're entering a world where there are 30,000 licensed Oregonians that may not be working in the profession or for a variety of reasons, I understand. But is somebody managing those expectations?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, I have no doubt that if it's not the universities, we're not a very big state. The word is out that jobs have been scarce. And I have a little slide coming up here that will show you that our enrollment in our Oregon prep programs is almost 50% what it was 5 years ago. So extrapolating that, because I hadn't inserted this in the presentation, I have been able to confidently say up until the last couple of years that we are not we're oversupplied, not over. We always have shortages geographically, and we always have shortages in ESOL, special education, math, and science. Those are incurable nationally. All right. But my very real fear and concern is that we're going to have real shortages coming up here in the next 5 years, because the recovery, it looks to me, on our market of teachers is a little bit like the housing market in Portland. It's like rising, but it's like, you know, a pebble at a time. And recovering from that kind of drop of interest in the profession, I think, is very difficult. I think also a conversation we can't have today because it would take too long is the debt issue is significant and it's real. And in 1989, Representative Vera Katz actually passed legislation that required all the public programs to go to master's MAT programs when we had been primarily undergraduate preparation programs. So what happened is the privates, in order to stay competitive, then all opened MAT programs, which adds on a whole graduate level of debt. And there is no difference in terms that we can tell, no quantifiable difference that we can tell between an undergrad prepared teacher and an MAT prepared teacher.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir. I was digesting that statement. Please.
Well, that I think addresses what I've been sitting here mulling over, trying to figure out. I have a daughter-in-law that's a second grade teacher with a master's degree, and I'm sorry, I'm not an educator, but you don't need a master's degree to teach second grade. And the educators on the panel can argue with me, that's fine.
I'm just moving closer to Doug.
I'm just, you know, but I think you may have answered my question, in that back in the 90s, Vera pushed for higher education levels for things, because I've always wondered, it's kind of like, I don't understand why we don't have an AA degree teaching certificate for certain things. Now, granted, you know, maybe that wouldn't be second grade or whatever, but my dad, after a year of college, got his teaching certificate and taught school for a while, you know, back in the 50s. And I know we've evolved, but some of the evolution, I sit back and I go, I can't, and I see it in private industry too, degree creep, where they're requiring degrees for things that, as a business guy, I know you don't need to have a baccalaureate degree to do that job.
Madam Chair, may I respond?
Please, Vicki, please.
Representative Huffman, there's so many doors I could just run through. But let me start with some of what was in the conventional wisdom. And I do think it does apply more to high school than it does to elementary teachers, and that is I became a teacher through the undergrad route, which means I gave up about 45 hours of content in my area in order to get my education classes, which I needed because it helps me work with developmental levels and second language children and special ed children and things like that. My point in that is that once that became evident, people believed that it would be way better particularly at the high school, for the math teacher to have a full bachelor's degree in math and then take a year of graduate school to learn how to teach the math. I'm telling you this because it will actually help you understand a little better what's going on with accelerated learning, because the community colleges and the higher ed folks to transcript those classes want these teachers to have graduate content. But when we flipped our model for teacher prep, these folks only have time to get in there. They do their placement, they get all their pedagogy, they learn how to work with kids all in one graduate year. So they don't have any time to take any graduate math, science, biology, whatever you would like. That theory, I would 100% agree with you, doesn't quite hold up for the elementary teacher and the person who knows they want to teach multiple subjects to young children. So it is definitely something I think that we could look at. And I will tell you, George Fox, because they're private and they have the ability and the flexibility, are looking at reopening their undergrad program. Western Oregon and Eastern Oregon have maintained undergrad programs for elementary teachers. And there are a few privates, Warner Pacific and some of the smaller ones, who are doing elementary preparation. So 45% of all of our brand new teachers are elementary teachers. And then you would go, oh my goodness. However, if you think about it, if they're able to teach through grade 8, 2/3 of our grades are elementary level education. So it's, you know, I don't know the answer, but I do know that we can't quantify data that says that the MAT route is the better route. It's just the one we adopted as a state, 30 plus years ago.
And the accelerated learning part that Vicki talked about for our task force, that's still one of the biggest areas that is under discussion about how to make sure a high school teacher is teaching the college level content, and what about certification and stuff like that. But we were talking about nursing also, so it's not just educators. We're, you know, the nursing industry is going to BSN, and you know, the healthcare community largely says we don't need all 4-year RNs. 2-year for a lot of things are just fine. So it's a little scary.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because we got into a little bit of the certification issues. When it comes to the universities and others that provide the staff training, we have no program in Oregon in a public institution that does vocational training like they used to. Or do we have any left? And if we do, how are we getting those people certified? Are we taking them from other states? Are we trying to figure out other opportunities to get them licensed? Because we have a real push right now in our state for CTE and STEM teachers.
Madam Chair, Senator Roblin, I get to kill two birds with this stone. Thank you very much. The AA bird.
Right.
And the CTE bird. The route to career and technical education from industry is fairly smooth. If they come in with the industry experience, we work with the Department of Education, and we use their work experience, and they may have an AA or they may not. You asked me at the front end of that.
Universities producing actual teachers.
Yes, thank you. I was here yesterday and heard a little bit of that. Here's Oregon's, we still have agriculture programs, family and consumer science, business and marketing, and we still have a few, what we call it technology, but it is such a misnomer to make you cry, the shop teacher. Those are active. Concordia and Oregon State are almost the only two universities right now who are providing them. And so, but they are there. They're just not high producers.
But through the AA for CTE?
Well, not just AA for CTE, but we do... we do allow AA for CTE, but we do also allow, for example, in Portland's magnet schools, they have whole areas of arts where they bring individual people in, like people who've taught dance, let's say, for 30 years and choreographed, and now they want to come in and teach. They don't even have 1 hour post high school, but you can't really ignore all of that, that beautiful portfolio they have and what they've done teaching these units and things. And so they get a limited license to teach in those areas. So we give out all kinds of subsets of whole subjects. They don't go in and teach all of the arts. They go in and they teach dance, or they may teach jazz band, or they may teach culinary arts, some subset of CTE, not a whole program. So we have remained very flexible about helping school districts get these folks licensed.
Senator Roblin.
And in many of those licenses, is it still my understanding that they are tied to the institution they're teaching at? So they can't transfer their certificate to another school?
Chair Comp, Senator Roblin, it used to be that way.
Okay.
But we actually, when we worked with ODE on the last go-around of career and technical ed, we made those, I guess you'd call it sort of universal licenses. They don't need to be sponsored by the school district. They need to be sponsored to enter, because you want to make sure that folks who've never been in the classroom are mentored, that they have someone they can rely on, particularly with student issues. And then after that, once they've completed the core coursework we want them to do, and that's working with diverse students, they're cut loose, if you will. They can take it anywhere.
Okay. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Comp. Do we have any licensure programs for teacher aides? So schools that have aides in the classroom, is that, are those folks licensed, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, we do not. We don't license them. We aren't in the preparation of them at all. The federal No Child Left Behind Act did also insist that IAs, instructional assistants, had at least a AA or equivalent, and they can test through that to get in. But a few states license instructional assistants. We never have.
Follow up. And so I just happen to know which states do have instructional assistants. Do you happen to know if they're, which, because it seems that a lot of the schools are needing aides in the classroom because the class sizes are so big. And I was just wondering if there was any discussion on your board about having expanding aides.
Chair Comp, Representative Taylor, the short answer is no, because instructional aides are totally different. Everything for the profession. And so there are, to back up even further, there are AA programs in the state that train instructional assistants.
Oh, okay.
However, it's not required to have the AA, the equivalent. So I hire a lot of ed assistants, and most of them pass their work keys test to be qualified. If we were to require a license for every instructional aide, I can tell you right now I would probably have a very difficult time finding any to do that work, because that's another hoop for them to jump
through. Yeah, I was just curious.
Yeah. So why the commission has never discussed it, is it's just a completely different role in the profession of education, and there never has been a licensure requirement in Oregon, and the concern would be that to require a license for an instructional assistant, especially because there's such differences. There's ESL, there's special education, there's high need special education that's more of a health service. There's a huge range of options that are needed, and so if we had licensure requirements for each of those, it could really tie our hands educationally.
Representative Springer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Excuse me. So I was up at a shop class, if you will, outside of my district this summer, and the principal at that school, they just got a very talented guy who was retired and came out of retirement for a year and said, I'm going to leave. But the reason I tell you that is they accessed this guy and twisted his arm, to get him there because they were having such a challenging time finding people that were not qualified but licensed to be to teach any level of CTE in the schools. So I'm wondering if they had other issues there they were wrestling with, or if, and I've heard this concern a couple times, more than a couple times over the last few years, or is it an issue of they just don't understand how to access that with TSPC, that it's not laid out for them, but there seems to be a disconnect between what is in place, the rule, and how that's translating to get people into the, quote, shop classes.
Chair Comp, Representative Springer, the here's what's happening. The up until the legislature funded CTE revitalization grants and provided state money for CTE, the only money going to school districts to do CTE programs was coming from federal Perkins funds. The federal Perkins funds had expectations about how licensure worked. So our licensure, which did the co-sponsorship and you had to have the license, actually has a significant part that ODE plays in it for those federal programs. Well, then this revitalization money came in. It wasn't tied to the federal funds. Frankly, we weren't aware of its proliferation out in the school districts. It was partly our lack of awareness. Creates all kinds of opportunities. You don't have to do the exact same expectations that the feds have to use those Perkins funds to fund CTE. So ODE had some turnover in staff, and we finally got together and figured out what was going on here and why we were having this problem. And now that we know we have it, as I was mentioning earlier, we have, without doing anything differently, several vehicles to get these folks licensed who aren't working in Perkins programs. And my point in that is there are emergency licenses, there are restricted licenses that let them actually go become fully prepared educators over the course of time. There are these limited licenses that require that they have the experience in AA or equivalent. Those are restricted to districts, but they're easy to obtain. And it was just a matter of lack of understanding of what was going on in the field and what was being funded and what license needed to do what, and now we know.
Paula, thank you. I think I understand. My question then is, if it is a Perkins-funded program, the requirement to be licensed is greater. And so if they're state funds, it's easier. And so how would a district, I'm putting my school board hat on, we talked a lot about Perkins money 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. How is a district managing that?
Madam Chair, Representative Springer.
First tell me if any of what I said is wrong.
It doesn't make sense to me. I understood everything you said.
That's helpful.
I think it's the best I can say is up until very recently with these new state-funded opportunities, these CTE programs had to look a certain way. In other words, and they had to be approved by ODE. That was sort of the connection. So a school district wanted federal funds. They went to the Department of Ed, and they said, we want to do a hospitality program. And so they actually took their curriculum and everything into the department's CTE section and had it approved. Once that program was approved, we then had the go-ahead to license folks who would come in and teach it. And it was approved. It was given access to Perkins funds. And then working with the department, people from the industry actually certify through the department to us that this person actually knows what they're talking about in hospitality, let's say. That information comes into our office and we give them their first license, and then we monitor from there how they're becoming prepared as a teacher. Then they get a permanently renewable 5-year license after 3 years. So that was life as I knew it, and we knew it in CTE until 2 years ago when the revitalization grants were born and state money started coming into schools. Great opportunities that weren't tied to this. Now districts don't have to go. So, for example, we've been doing this. Somebody could say, we want to do a fire science class. Great. We have this firefighter who wants to do a fire science class. We'll give you a limited teaching license in fire science. We want to do a public safety class. Great. We'll give you a limited teaching license in public safety or law enforcement. And so this is how we've been handling it. It's not a full-blown hospitality, full-blown engineering, full-blown accounting or information communications, all those areas we have. So I hope that makes some sense. This is the only license that we are tied very closely with the department and work very closely with them on how it works so it doesn't violate any Perkins regulations. But if it's not being funded with federal funds, then we have the ability to, they could have a CTE license. There's nothing that prohibits that, but we could probably get them licensed much more quickly through another route.
Can I add to that? Sure. Sorry, I'm also like Madam Chair, Representative Springer. You very accurately just summed up when I spoke in the beginning about how I had all these misconceptions. You just hit the nail on the head with where a lot of that comes from. Because what happens is there's all of these federal restrictions and different state laws, but to the consumer, anytime something becomes complicated or difficult, it's a TSPC problem. When in actuality, it's not. Most of the time, when there's a challenge, aside from license processing time, when there's a challenge with TSPC, it's usually not TSPC. So I just had a teacher, or actually a groundskeeper with a bachelor's degree, and he wanted to add horticulture. He wanted to become a horticulture teacher. This is what his bachelor's is in. If it was anything other than a CTE position, I could have him licensed like that because he already has a bachelor's. He's already highly qualified because of his bachelor's being in the content area. All I would have to do is apply for a restricted license that gives him a time to get a license. Then he'd have a couple years to complete his master's for the full or a teacher prep program. He'd be golden. We'd be good on running. But because it's a CTE program, he had to go through the ODE version first. The ODE requirements, because of Perkins, not because ODE was doing anything wrong, but because of the Perkins requirement, he had a list this long to jump through. So what he ultimately decided is if he wants to go into education, instead of getting CTE endorsed and really doing the egg horticulture route he wanted to do, he'll become a high school science teacher instead because it will be easier. So that's the reality, but in those types of situations, because, and I would hope he wouldn't say this because I walked him through all of it ahead of time, but he may be out there saying, oh, talk TSPC, I couldn't do it. But the reality is the only thing that prohibited him from doing that was the path that was required for the federal funding. If we had the CTE revitalization grant dollars, we could work it much differently and we could be fine. So those are all the minutiae that matter.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Springer, really quickly, one other point, and that is, I know Doug's probably really worried about me getting through my slides. We went through 4 years ago. We took all the CTE courses and actually did a correlation to the already licensed teachers. So there is there are a lot of biology science type classes in agriculture that a biology teacher can teach, and we assign those to those licenses to give districts flexibility to not have to go through these other routes. We were talking out in the hall, what we have to overcome are things that happen in education and other places all the time. The people from industry don't think the teachers who haven't been out in industry know enough about the area and are qualified enough to teach their stuff. And the teachers who have the industry people come in have the same thing. You know, they haven't worked with students, they haven't been in a classroom, and they don't, you see where I'm going. And Heidi brilliantly laid out let's just start doing more partnerships. Let's bring that industry person in. Let's have them work with a teacher who has a similar background instead of saying you have to have, you know, 2,000 hours of industry exposure or X number this way, and I think we can possibly find some solutions. We just have to remain open to alternatives.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
And so it's one more of the questions that we probably need to ask when we have Rob back, because if we're going to increase funding to schools based on CTE programs, what does a CTE program mean in that formula? And does it mean a Perkins program? Because that's a lot different than what CTE might mean to somebody else. And it definitely means a lot more with respect to who they have teaching those courses and whether they really count for one or the other programs. And it's something that we really need to understand more as we move forward, because as you just heard, our agencies haven't necessarily been talking because they didn't know they needed to for a while until all of a sudden this came up.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along those lines, that just made me think, how many licenses, how many types, what is the number of types of licenses that TSPC approves or provides, or whatever is the correct issues. Terminology? Issues, thank you.
So I think she's asking endorsements as opposed to licenses, because there's teaching licenses, then there's endorsements within the license with respect to subject matter and
or
other
maybe
things.
Both.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Smith-Warner, I've never been asked that precise question. I'm going to give you a very imprecise answer, way too many. And so, and that is actually one of the things we want to solve. So there are probably somewhere in the neighborhood of about 15 teaching licenses, and this would be an emergency, a substitute, a CTE, a new teacher, a professional teacher, and we have an old licensure system, which is one of my bills to fix. The subject matter area is even more problematic, but if you look at it just head on, there are about 32 different subjects that teachers can become licensed in: biology, chemistry, math, you know, elementary, that kind of thing. So what has happened is licenses have been created to address specific need rather than looking at how that need might be able to be covered by existing areas. And so we've been working for the last 3 years to just kind of dump all that, have everybody on one license, crunch the subject areas to where they make sense, and simplify. So in my opinion, it's way too many. I think the public and school districts and educators can be served by a little bit tighter system. But I don't have a number. Do you want a number?
Sure. Yes, please. Not right this moment.
No, thank you.
Well, and I hate to bring up the subject, but the licensure for, we talked a little bit about elementary, but in order to be highly qualified as a middle school teacher, you have to have a master's in your subject area that you're teaching. Whereas if you're a high school teacher, you don't always have to have that master's in your subject area. Mm-hmm. So that's not, is that wrong, right? Heidi's looking right, and you're looking no.
I mean,
Madam Chairman, sort of. And so, but that
well, it's been 10 years since I have been hiring.
But that comes back to that federal highly qualified.
Exactly.
So the feds have all these different requirements. The updated version is that now they can also test out. But again, they'd be having to take tests to teach. You could have a high school teacher teaching math that would be not qualified to teach middle school mathematics.
Correct.
Under the current system, which is so silly. But that's one of the things that license redesign, one of the big, whenever you'd hear TSPC did this, oftentimes it was Title IIA highly qualified requirements that were the real beast in the room. So with license redesign, Vicki has done an absolutely masterful job of aligning federal requirements to state requirements in such a way that if the federal requirements change, our state requirements are sound. That's a difficult task. And she has done it with license redesign in a way that's truly exciting. So I think we're getting to where we need to go. So a lot of that silliness is out the window.
Well, and thank you, because literally you could lose a highly qualified language arts teacher at the middle school, but she had the licensure to teach at the high school, and it's just like, okay, what's wrong with this picture?
Exactly.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, just to put a bow on it, what happened with highly qualified that really became a mess at the middle school is that we licensed teachers to teach K-8, and they were licensed in multiple subjects, and nationally people have been doing that for a long time, and we've learned that elementary prepared teachers can be as successful with 7th and 8th graders as high school single subject teachers can be with middle school teachers. The federal government decided if you're going to teach 7th grade and you're going to teach 8th grade, you need to have the same level of high school subject matter depth that the high school teacher has. And so all of these elementary teachers who for decades had been teaching social studies and math and language arts suddenly had to go out and either pass a test or pick up some coursework.
Right.
And it was a horrible, horrible mess. And so that's what happened. They cut a crisp line for secondary and knowledge, and the states basically had to come in line.
Right, and the middle school teacher was caught in the crosshairs.
Yes. Nationally. I think I can quickly get through program approval and stop before discipline.
Madam Chair, just a reality check. We have 10 minutes. We're a quarter of the way through the slide, so we definitely carry over till tomorrow or on Monday. But I do want to give the opportunity, since we announced public testimony today, and I only see two people in the audience, and I know one of them works for the agency. Is there anyone that wants to provide public testimony on this bill? Okay, that opportunity is then closed.
Okay, thank you.
So I will cover this very quickly. The program approval is really state-level accreditation, and surprisingly, a large number of people don't know the agency does this. But if you'll move to the graph here, this shows you the picture I was telling you about earlier in terms of the drop in new students. And the colored bars are the public programs and the private programs. And I think what's very interesting is until 07-08, for all the data I could see, publics were preparing more than the privates. When we went through our depression, recession, our great recession, whatever we're calling it, the privates actually were doing better. And I think this has to do a little with higher education cuts, and the privates have access to scholarship money and things often that the publics do not. As you can see, it's kind of flip-flopping again. But in 08-09, nearly 2,300 this is teachers only. This doesn't count any new administrators and everybody else. Folks were being prepared by our universities, and our last year of reporting, 13-14, last spring was 1,425. When I said, looking down the pipeline, I think we're going to see in a few years we may have a problem. So moving on, just want to, these are the universities, and what we call them units, who are preparing educators, and it includes Salem-Keizer, who actually has a counseling program, and we have one little sliver of our statute that allows us to approve those kind of programs. Part of our proposed legislation would open that up so we have more opportunity to look at more alternative models for preparation in that regard. Then this is a breakdown of our completers by university. The top five, it's a little bit like that, school district statistic, complete, prepare almost half of the completers, those top five preparers. And then if you look on the far right there, that six that are 20-ish or under, that has been about their preparation numbers. On the other hand, during when times were better, those were almost double or triple the number they were preparing. At one point, Portland State was preparing more than 350 teachers a year, and you can see how far that has come down. We lost two programs in the last 2 years. Willamette closed, and University of Phoenix in Oregon closed as a part of this. Another interesting statistic that we often don't think about is the ratio of our new teachers to our out-of-state people who are coming in the state. And we used to hear from the economists that the incoming migration was slowing down, but that isn't evident in our profession. It has been fairly static, as you can see. But what we haven't seen since I have been here is nearly 43% of our new folks coming in from out of state. Now, keep in mind, they're new to us, but they're not necessarily new to the profession. They could be veterans and all kinds of other things. And with that in mind, I do want you to know the commission has made reciprocity as easy as possible. We accept out-of-state tests. We accept their out-of-state license. We fingerprint them, and we get them down the road on a license that's as closely equivalent to the one they came in on. And then this just gives you an idea of our kind of accreditation cycle. I have a 0.8 FTE who handles this workload. And so later on, I'll talk about that more. Heidi, do you want to talk about how this works at the commission level?
Sure. So at the commission level, we're reviewing feedback from how the teachers are doing that have finished the programs. We're looking at racial and ethnic diversity and completion levels. We're looking at the actual samples from student work and the coursework syllabi. It's an intense evaluation. There's a lot of discussion at the commission level for each of these program reviews, and it's something that a lot of people don't realize that the commission does, but that they take very seriously.
Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How does this tie into what you talked about, the unexplainable acronym earlier, the EDPAT? EDPAT? EDTPA. Two questions. So from here on out, new licensees from in-state programs are going to be able to across the board take this assessment, and that's what you're going to utilize for their licensure. Is that correct? Okay. And then I was going to say it's a multiple part. So yeah. So that's the first question. Number two, will that impact this approval process? Because that would beg the question, if you did this big effort with them and got to this set of standards, might that decrease the amount of, you know, program review you need to do? That's my second question. And and in renewals, will those new assessments impact renewals at all, or is it just going to have to be a grandfathered phase in, as most things like this are?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith-Warner, EDTPA, there used to be various portfolios that were done at the different colleges with different standards for
kinda
completion.
Kind of like Sim and Cam?
Exactly like Sim and Cam. That's a great reference. So, yes.
A blast.
But everyone had a different criteria. What EDTPA does is says everybody's going to have the same standard, same criteria, but there's a lot of flexibility in how it's implemented, but essentially same exit standards. Where it impacts program review will not necessarily be that we need to review programs less, but it will be one new piece of data in the program review so that we can say a lot of your students are passing their EDTPA. Why? What are you doing to better prepare students? And we can have those tough conversations. The other thing for renewals, it's only for brand new teachers new to the profession.
Madam Chair and Representative Smith-Warner, to flesh that out a little bit more, the implementation of the EDTPA, which is kind of the culmination of their student teaching or clinical practice performance, it has to be videotaped and people look at it and score it, as Heidi mentioned, is only one assessment. So the commission has adopted it. They did it last winter. This year we spent training faculty. Next year, 30% have to take it, so we can take that data on how they perform and give it to faculty so they can make any adjustments they have to. The following academic year, 100% have to take it to get licensed, but it won't be consequential. Then what we'll do is we'll take that data in and use it to set our score for the assessment. So it becomes fully consequential. In other words, they won't get a license unless they pass it in the spring of 2018. And nationally, that's sort of an aggressive launch for that sort of thing. What we look at when we do this We look at all their programs, elementary preparation and secondary preparation, et cetera. But we also look at what assessments they are using. Are they using tests and how are they doing it? Is it valid? So this is one assessment just for teachers. We look at their administrator prep. We look at the counselors. We look at the qualifications of their faculty. We look to see if their faculty are engaged in K-12 education. They know what the heck's going on now in classrooms. We look at the diversity of their students and whether they're making any efforts to diversify their faculty and diversify their candidates. Actually, Oregon has the toughest standard on that in terms of laying conditions if we don't see they're actively attempting to recruit. And that master's degree is a barrier. I'll come back to that on Monday. And we also look at the kind of support they have. This looks busy, and it is. It just happens to be a coincidental collision of a lot of visits, but they're on a 7-year review cycle.
That's my next question. Thank you.
Okay. And
One other thing. I'm sorry, Representative Comp, real fast. Washington is actually using a performance assessment for renewal, first state in the nation to do that. It's on the horizon. And there's some federal accountability things that may lead Oregon that way. So sorry.
Okay. And we basically are out of time, but Representative Springer, did you have a question to bring us to closure?
And I think it should be a fairly short answer, I'm certainly hoping. Are we, looking at these last few slides I was trying to sort through and I can't, are we an importer or exporter of teachers?
Madam Chair, Representative Springer, I don't know for sure. I don't think we're a whole lot of either, frankly. I think that there are some school districts who have the money to recruit out of state for second language teachers, but I don't think it's extremely high numbers. And I do think that people like to stay mostly where they're being prepared. And all I have is anecdotal evidence about people leaving.
Thank you.
And committee? No committee tomorrow, Senator Co-Chair Monroe.
Yeah, when the ladies come back on Monday, I'm very interested in discipline. I'm very interested in how many cases you have, how long it's taking you to work through the caseload, whether the additional budget that you're asking for and additional staff is going to meet that need. Those are some decisions that I need some answers to when you come back on Monday.
Will do. Senator Groveland, did you have a comment?
Nope.
Okay. Well, at this time, we're going to carry over Senate Bill 5538, and we are adjourned.